I'm Beth Hover, a member of the board for Our Community Cares volunteer organization, and you're in tune to 90.7 FM, WGXC, Accra.
You can find all about the Hudson-based circus, the Bindlesif Family Circus, on the WGXC community calendar. They're hosting the Bindlesif Circus's Summer of Joy 2022 in Hudson, with five different programs for youth ages 6 through young adults, including circus art intensives for youth and participation in the Hudson Black Arts and Cultural Festival Parade. Also work on costume design and fabrication. They host the Hudson Juggling Club at Waterfront Wednesdays in Hudson, and a restorative justice facilitation training with the Hudson Youth Center and the Restorative Center of Newburgh. These programs run from June 29th to August 24th, You can find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Marcus DeGrazia Acupuncture of Austerlitz, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to Music and Time on WGXC, the show that puts albums in their historical context. I'm your host, Evan McCormick. On the last few episodes, we've taken a look at the social, political, and even environmental context of some albums when they came out. This week, we're going to do something different and think about how people consume music. And to do that, I want to take you back to a place in time that is very near and dear to my heart. The mid-1990s, fall 1995 to be exact. I was 14 years old, if you're wondering, a middle schooler, but this isn't about me. Let's imagine you're a teenager. You're into music, you devour what's on the radio, but you want more of what's on the album. There are just a few problems. One, maybe it's not so easy for you to get to a record store. You don't live near a mall, much less a city, so you can't get to the Sam Goody, let's say. Two, you're a teenager. You don't have a lot of money, and most CDs these days cost you north of $15. Salvation comes in the form of a magazine. Not the magazine itself, but an insert inside of it, which promises something unbelievable. 8 CDs for the price of one, and nothing more to buy ever. The insert itself is covered in hundreds of albums which could be yours. It sounds so tantalizing, and maybe too good to be true, but maybe not. So you pull away the mail-in card from the insert, you pick your 5 free CDs, and you mail it back. And now, my friend, your musical future awaits because you have just gained entry into a subscription music club. What in the world am I talking about? So from the 1950s all the way to the 2000s, subscription music clubs were a prime way for music listeners, especially young ones, to build their collections on a budget. In the 1990s especially, this system peaked, and competition between two of those clubs, Columbia House and BMG, helped drive CD sales through the roof. But the clubs weren't without their drawbacks for consumers, for artists, and, of course, for record stores. We'll be exploring this phenomenon on today's episode of Music and Time by focusing on an album that might have been one of the free ones you selected and which arrived late in 1995, from a California ska band that was scratching and clawing its way into relevance and was about to explode. It's No Doubt's Tragic Kingdom, and this is the first single off that album, Just a Girl.
Take this pink ribbon off my eyes. I'm exposed, and it's no big surprise. Don't you think I know exactly where I stand? This world is forcing me to hold your hand. 'Cause I'm just a girl, a little lonely. Well, don't let me out of your sight. Oh, I'm just a girl, already at fatigue. So don't let me have any rights. Oh, I've had enough to hear. The moment that I step outside, so many reasons for me to run and hide. I can't do the little things I love so dear, 'cause it's all those little things that I fear. 'Cause I'm just a girl, I'd rather not be, 'cause they won't let me drive late at night. Oh, I'm just a girl, guess I'm some kind of freak, 'cause the old things there with their eyes. Oh,
so your free CDs arrive in a small cardboard box. You're overjoyed. But now what? Well, here's how these music clubs tended to work. Once you had your free CDs, the membership required you to fulfill some obligation. Now, I belonged to BMG twice, actually, where the deal was you had to buy one CD at full price, which would then unlock the balance of your free albums. Columbia House, at least during my time, they gave you more total albums, but you had to commit to buy several over the course of your membership. I'll be honest, the deal still sounds good. I can remember the feeling of basically tripling my CD collection in seventh grade in one fell swoop. But what was the catch? Well, each month the clubs would send you a catalog that you could shop from, and in the catalog was a card telling you what next month's featured selection was from the genre that you had indicated typified your music taste. And if you didn't want that club selection, you had to send the postcard back and say so. If you didn't, that album was coming in the mail to you along with a bill for the full price, which was between $16 and $18 for a full price CD. You could, of course, send the unopened album back, but you'd be responsible for the shipping. It's something called negative option billing. And if you were anything like me, getting that card back in the mail in time was a bit of a challenge, which led to, let's just say, my first experiences with debt. And I don't think I was alone. In fact, in just a minute, we're going to be hearing from Professor Larry Miller at New York University Steinhardt about how the business side of these clubs worked. But before I do that, it's worth stressing just how popular these clubs were. In the early to mid-1990s, Columbia House membership floated between 8 and 10 million subscribers, with about the same for BMG. Columbia House, which was much older, claimed to have sold 1 billion albums by 1990, and in 2003, BMG claimed that it had sold about 300 million in its roughly 15-year existence. The market share of these clubs, that's the percentage of all music sales that they represented, peaked in 1994 at about 15.1%, and in 1995, it had dipped just a little to 14.3%. That's still quite a large percentage of the market, and that's the year that No Doubt's Tragic Kingdom came out. So you might be wondering why I picked this album. Well, yes, one reason is I love it, but this album also happens to sit at number 13 on the all-time list of BMG Music Club bestsellers, and from a relatively small and unknown label at the time, Trauma. I'll talk about that list and why that might be interesting a little later in the show. In the meantime, I could think of no better album than Tragic Kingdom to illustrate the way that these clubs gave young people choices that began to really shape them into a buying public. Now, in a store, your money might get you one or two albums in a visit. In the club, on the other hand, seeing hundreds of choices in a catalog at a discount, you could begin to think in multiples. You could begin to cultivate a taste for yourself. And that was what was so empowering. Well, at least until the company rep called about that $20 I owed anyway. So here's a song for that company rep about being purposely hard to reach. The second single off Tragic Kingdom in the opening track, released in November of 1995. It's Spiderwebs.
Chemistry's correct. Your words walk right through my ears. You're listening to Music in Time on WGXC. This is your host, Evan McCormick. I'm joined today by Larry Miller, clinical professor and director of the Music Business Program at New York University's Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development. He teaches there about the music business. He's also got decades of experience in the business himself. He's the host of the Musinomics podcast. Larry, thanks for joining us today to help us demystify the phenomenon of record clubs.
Glad to be here, Evan.
So this episode is focused a bit on the CD clubs of the mid-1990s, namely BMG and Columbia House. But the first question I had for you is, what's the lineage of these music clubs before them? Where did the idea come from?
Well, in the mid-50s, 1955 is when Columbia House started. And the idea was to put together a way to help further maximize the profits of the recorded music industry as it existed in that, you know, pre-Beatle, pre-Elvis even, pre-rock era. And so the idea took hold in 1955. It's also worth noting that in the same year, the RCA Music Club, later when RCA was acquired by BMG, or when the recorded music operations were acquired by BMG, that happened in the same year too. And those two businesses, Columbia House and RCA, later the BMG Music Club, were brutal competitors in this space all the way through the end of the, you know, club format as we know it.
So judging by longevity, the business model clearly worked, but I want to get a sense for how it worked. So in short, I mean, these look like snazzy, unsustainable promotions, 12 CDs for a penny, that kind of thing. How did they actually work for the clubs?
Well, I guess in a few different ways. Let's start, let's start with the consumer offer first. So if that offer was 12 CDs or tapes or records, depending on what era and music formats we're talking about, for a penny, you know, that was a pretty strong come on. And, you know, many millions of people participated over, you know, really a very long period of time. Although what came along with the 12 CDs for a penny was to buy some number, usually three, four, five records over the next year at regular club prices, which were always at suggested retail prices, which, to give you an example, in an era when CDs, for example, were selling in brick-and-mortar shops for $10 to $12, those same records, or at least the same titles, were being sold for $18, $19, $20, plus shipping and handling of $2 to $3 a unit. So it would end up costing the consumer about $22 a unit for each CD they bought at regular club prices, which even when netted out with the essentially free-to-the-consumer offer that got them, you know, into the customer relationship with the clubs to begin with, was still very profitable for quite a long time for the clubs.
Did the music clubs have an effect on record sales? And that might be another way of my asking you, what incentives do the record companies have to work with the clubs to get their music out?
Yeah. So there were lots of incentives. For one, club sales counted toward gold and platinum certification and also chart position. So that was a pretty powerful incentive. But there was another one that was not spoken or written about very much at the time, and that was the reduced royalty rate that the labels and songwriters in particular were required to sign off on in order to make those records available through the clubs. And so while on the one hand, the revenue that was coming into the clubs from the, you know, product sales to consumers was, you know, significant and profitable enough, on the cost side, you know, costs were dramatically less just in terms of royalty exposure for the clubs than they were for the record companies, say, for a you know, a regular CD or album that you would buy in a regular brick and mortar store.
Yeah, were artists getting any royalties on the whatever number of CDs you got for a penny from a Columbia House in that case?
Right. Well, it's hard to get confirmation on this, but I have looked at some agreements that date back to that era. And there were a number of artist agreements that counted as free goods, records that were sold through or licensed through to the clubs. There were also other agreements that counted them partially as free goods. So for example, an artist would get whatever their royalty rate was on one unit sold, but the same one unit would generate a you know, one unit's worth of free goods. So essentially, they were getting half their royalty rate, and at the same time, songwriters were getting three quarters of their rate or less for those same sales.
Wow. How did music retailers, you've mentioned the brick and mortars, especially in this period of the 1990s, I think of, you know, your mall music stores, your Sam Goody's, your Specs, how did they feel about album clubs giving people a different way to build pretty large CD collections without ever setting foot in their stores?
Well, they didn't love it. That's for sure. And as a business practice, they really forced the record clubs fairly early on in the long before the 90s to hold off new releases from being made available through the clubs for a period of 6 months after release. That was later reduced to 90 days, you know, 3 months. And so there was, I'm going to say, not so peaceful coexistence between the brick-and-mortar retailers and the clubs. It's also worth noting that many of the members of the clubs were underage kids who were just getting started with their physical record collections. And so it was sort of a fast way to get a dozen records, you know, delivered for a penny. And of course, many of those debts that were later incurred by those same young kids were written off and uncollectible.
Yeah, we haven't spoken about the negative option, but I was a BMG member myself, and there was the monthly responsibility to return the card saying you didn't want the item. And I think there were a number of unintentional CDs added to my collection because I didn't return the card, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, and you were not alone in that regard. Yeah, negative option as a business model and really as a business practice is not so popular. And I think that at the end of their days, which really didn't happen until the you know, around 2010 or 2011 or so, that the companies had, or at least the products, by then the business had consolidated and there was really only one company left, but the companies had a less than favorable rating from the Better Business Bureau.
So you teach about the evolution of the music industry and you been involved in it, you think a lot about it. What do you think the effect was on the way the music culture, the consumer public thought about CDs as a result of these music clubs? Do you think they had an impact on the way we thought about or valued music coming in CD format?
I do think they had an impact, and not just on the CD format, but just on the value of music in general. I mean, if we go back to the vinyl era, that was 1955 through, you know, the 60s and 70s and into the early 80s was during the birth and ascendance and domination of the 12-inch LP format. And I think that the clubs were a fantastic accelerator for many people, especially for many young people, and especially those not living in big cities that had many great, fun retailers close by, readily accessible, with great selection and decent pricing. And so I think the clubs were a good thing from the perspective of making music accessible, at least somewhat affordable in at least the early offer for, many millions of consumers and really for several generations.
And my last question for you, are these just a relic of a bygone era, or do you see them as somehow connected to our music landscape now in 2022?
You know, it's I do study this stuff, as you as you mentioned, and to be perfectly honest with you, at their peak, the record clubs were responsible for a significant amount, I mean up to 15% of industry revenues during their biggest years, which were in the early 90s and the early 1990s, which happens to coincide with the beginning of the commercial internet. And if we think about the very first click-to-buy offers on Amazon and on the websites of the very early internet retailers that even preceded Amazon's entry into the music business, I think of the New York-based company N2K, which had a company called Music Boulevard. I think of a company that was based in Philadelphia that came a couple of years later called CD Now, that you may remember, that all preceded, not only the streaming business, but the entire download business. And, of course, during those same years, in the early to mid to late 90s, there were lots of, on the one hand, responsible, and on the other hand, not so responsible experiments when it came to music streaming and downloading. But it's hard to imagine how today, given the options that we have to discover and consume pretty much whatever we want at a fixed price, the basic streaming model that a half a billion people around the world are now paying for at Spotify and Apple Music and other premium music services, could possibly compete with or how the clubs could possibly compete with that offer. Having said that, fandom today is expressed in lots of different ways. Lots of vinyl records are bought by people who have no intention of really playing them, or might have an intention of playing them. They may not have a turntable. And I think that certain kinds of physical goods packages, and vinyl records in particular, just provide that kind of tactile relationship with the artist and the other music creators to engage fans in a way that just isn't possible with streaming.
Well, you're speaking to somebody who believes that personally, so that's a great point to end on. Larry, thanks so much for taking time with us. You can hear Professor Larry Miller on the Musonomics podcast, wherever you get your podcast. Larry, thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Pathetic little me.
trying my shoes on for a change.
Welcome back. That was No Doubt's Sunday Morning, the fifth, you heard me right, fifth single off Tragic Kingdom. I'm Evan McCormick, and you're listening to Music in Time on WGXC, the show where we put albums in their historical context. And that's what we're doing today. Notably, I'm not giving you the backstory of this album or the band, although there are loads of great features out there about that that I highly recommend. Our job here is to resurface some of what the world of the listeners was like. And in today's case, exploring one of the ways that listeners bought and consumed this album in particular, the music clubs. Now, before playing Sunday Morning, you heard me talking to Larry Smith, a professor at NYU Steinhardt, where he teaches on the music business. And there are a few aspects of what he mentioned about the music clubs that are directly relevant to No Doubt and to Tragic Kingdom. The first is how long this album was on the charts. So did you catch Larry mention that there was a waiting period between an album's release and when it was made available through the clubs? At first 6 months and then later reduced to 90 days? This was negotiated by the record stores so that the clubs didn't cut into their sales, a sticking point throughout most of the 1990s. Well, this album, Tragic Kingdom, didn't even crack the top 100 until February 1996, 5 months after its release. And it hit number one in December of 1996, 15 months after it dropped. And one of the reasons for this was that there was a stream of seven singles that kept this album front of listeners' minds. The last single, Hey You, was released 2.5 years after the first single, Just a Girl. Well, when an album's on the charts for so long, that waiting period doesn't matter so much. This album's lifespan coincided almost directly with the height of the music club's power and was in the record catalogs for this entire time that the singles are coming out on the radio. So that leads to the second thing I want to mention, which is the tyranny of sales. As of 2003, the last data that anyone seems to have on this, No Doubt's Tragic Kingdom had sold 1.32 million units from BMG Music Club alone. You might have heard Larry Miller mention to me that these numbers were calculated for RIAA certification. this is gold, platinum records and whatnot. Well, according to the research that I've done, this wasn't always the case, but was permitted after 1994. So no doubt timing couldn't have been better. And according to the data, those 1.32 million were something like a tenth of the U.S. sales recorded for Tragic Kingdom. So in other words, a significant number that helped this album get certified, eventually diamond status, that's 10 times platinum, in 1999, a remarkably fast trajectory. You know, there were drawbacks for artists. They didn't see full royalties on these albums, as Larry pointed out, a cut down on the money that they would get for the sales of discs through the record clubs. Also, because record clubs would license the music and press and package the CDs themselves, artists lost some control over how their album was marketed or seen by the public. But I'm here to tell you that in the mid-1990s, sales drove everything. And that's why No Doubt's place on this BMG list, number 13, is so wild. Because if you look at what else is around it on that list, it's a lot of either deep catalog material, say the Eagles, AC/DC, things that are going to sell all the time. And then really in-your-face pop from that moment in the 1990s, stuff I don't really want to relive on this show, NSYNC, Britney Spears, and whatnot. But then there are a few albums on this list that came out on smaller independent labels, including Tragic Kingdom, which came out on Trauma. This suggests that smaller labels could perhaps use the clubs to increase their clout. Another thing I notice is that there are two women who seem to dominate the list for the reason that they span this divide between the pop and the catalog. Janet Jackson and Shania Twain. Twain's Come On Over, in fact, sits at the very top of the list, just shy of 2 million copies sold through BMG Music Club. Janet Jackson, on the other hand, she's all over it. Five albums in the top 100, including 1993's Janet, which was featured as a special promotion by BMG when it came out. The thing is, her numbers are almost definitely undercounted, because in 1995, Virgin Music pulled its catalog out of BMG Music Club because of pressure from artists. Now, there's a website out there called Chartmasters that features some articles on the music clubs from 2016, where they try and get a more accurate accounting for Janet Jackson's record sales based on the club math. I highly recommend those. Shout out to Chartmasters. But in the meantime, here's a killer song from Janet. It's If, followed up with a track by another artist on the top 100 list who was featured in a BMG promotion, which gave her indie record a boost towards diamond certification. It's Alanis Morissette's You Oughta Know. We'll be right back.
Every time you speak her name, does she know how you
listening to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick. Now, I did a little bit of quick and dirty research using social media before this episode, and I asked my friends and followers how many of you belonged to a music club when you were younger, and if you did your account stay current, or did you end up in debt? About half of you who responded, shout out to all of you, said that you were part of a music club, so about 50%. That's pretty high. And of that 50%, another 50% ended up in debt at some point. Now, don't worry, I won't be reporting you. As you might have heard Larry Miller mention earlier, these debts have since been written off. Now, I started this episode off by talking about youth. And to be fair, I've seen data that says the average age of club subscribers was about 32, so perhaps a little older than my teenage self. But there was something going on in that these clubs were seeking to tap into music that young people wanted to hear. And what I've been trying to suggest in this episode is that the clubs, with their discount pricing, lowered the barrier enough that young people could actually start calling the shots about what they would buy. As I said before, that was empowering for a teenager like me. But for the record labels and the clubs, it was intoxicating. If you want to dig into this, there's a great documentary called The Target Shoots First by Chris Wilcha, an NYU philosophy grad student who in the 1990s went behind the lines to work for Columbia House. He wrestles with his own identity as a punk as the club is seeking to capitalize on the shift towards alternative music from the corporate center. It's great. And this show is about consumers of just that product. I was one of them. And so here's a song from one of my first batch of free CDs, an alternative classic that sticks with me to this day. Thanks, BMG. This is Seether by Veruca Salt.
Black noise.
Whatever happened to these music clubs? Great question. In 2005, BMG purchased Columbia House, merging two longtime bitter rivals. They were then purchased by an investment company and renamed Direct Brands. Their music mail order operations ended in 2009, but the model persisted for a few years for DVDs. But looking back, it's hard to imagine how this model could have survived the streaming era. It feels like it was always doomed. So what does it all mean? Ultimately, that's a question for you to answer, but I'll tell you what I think. I think the music clubs can in some way be seen as related to the streaming era because of their emphasis on loyalty and choice, or at least the illusion of it. See, signing up for access to one club or the other's catalog in the 1990s is not totally unlike signing up for access to one or the other streaming service and all that it offers you. And the seeming omnipotence offered by these streaming services to play almost anything under the sun on demand, well, it's not unlike looking through those pages of catalog titles and discount prices. It was so intoxicating to my teenage brain. The basic element is that these music clubs gave buyers power, or at least the feeling of power that came with choosing how you were going to spend your money, less money, of course, to cultivate taste. Now that bar is even lower. Music feels free, access feels unlimited. But in both models, there are strings attached. Most obvious today is the lack of tactile connection to what you're paying for with subscription services. And in the streaming model, the connection between the music you choose and who you are, well, that seems even more fleeting too. No longer are you even picking a genre to be marketed by your corporate interlocutors. Now the algorithm just makes that choice for you. So forgive me if I'm a little nostalgic for the record club days, warts and all, but I do recognize in both models the artists pay a cost, not just financially, but in that connection between artists and listeners that comes through in the album itself, that's getting stretched and in ways that are often hidden from the consumer. So whatever you think about the clubs and their practices or about the conveniences of streaming, don't forget to support your favorite acts, especially independent ones, in ways that are as direct as possible. That's what's going to save music in the end. Now, I could save more, but in the words of No Doubt, let's end it on this.